So I'm here with Stephen today, and we're gonna continue our ongoing series concerning Iraq. As a programming note, I know these interviews on Iraq are sort of, just one subject matter than another. I think in the future we're gonna put everything on Storify along with some of the interviewees, their works, and their sort of writing. So as a listener, you can access everything in a much more organized and sort of interesting, more accessible fashion rather than interview to interview. Let's start with Stephen. Give us a sort of update of what's going on in Iraq right now in terms of politics and in terms of what's happening. Because I think a lot of the audience and especially me, we sort of Iraq has sort of fallen off the radar, and it's sort of it's not being covered other than, within a group of Iraq specialists and Iraq analysts. So give us an update.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right, and I think unfortunately, what we really see is, Iraq is still in political stalemate and still suffering from the same old problems, which obviously sort of neglect the inflections within what's going on. What we have right now, we've just seen a round of provincial elections in most of Iraq, with the exception of Kirkuk. And the Kurdistan region, the three provinces there. Broadly, they were a, it was a surprising set of results. Prime Minister Maliki did relatively well. He came out relatively, the strong, probably the strongest single actor, but far less well than he would have expected or liked, and came out with nothing like the mandate that he would have wanted, given that he is facing parliamentary elections next year. Similarly, among the Sunni political sort of landscape, Sunni Arab landscape, Parliamentary Speaker Hassan al-Najafi, who is Maliki's, really his key Sunni rival, came out far less strongly than he would have liked. And various groups that have sort of been less influential over the last few years, particularly Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, came out relatively strongly and were able to play a sort of king-making role in a lot of places. So in a lot of ways, what we've come out with is a more an even more fragmented political scene than we had before in Iraq. Which, given how hard Prime Minister Maliki has tried to, how successfully he's been in consolidating power around his office, it's an interesting set of developments. In the meantime, we still have stalemate with regard to the negotiations with the Kurds to the north about their economic issues and really their political place in Iraq. And playing into all of this, or in many ways driving it, has been a massive rise in violence, much of which can be attributed to Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Islamic State in Iraq, but not all of it. And with that, a remobilize what looks very much like a remobilization of Shia militant groups. So none of the trends are particularly encouraging, and there are inflections within what's going on, but that's sort of probably where we are at the moment.
Interesting. So, I mean, in terms of the Sunni Arabs, what has been sort of the main narrative in describing the government? Because, I mean, you have a excellent write-up that talks about how, the Sunni Arabs have gone from a protest movement to a more sort of militarized, more, more likely to use violence. So, I mean, through all this sort of turmoil in this period, what has been sort of the main narrative, in Sunni Arab areas towards the central government?
Sure. Well, the basic narrative really has had a lot of the same central points since really going back to the constitution writing process to sort of 2005 period of time. If you look at the 13 demands that were released in January by the supporters of, I forget what the camp was calling itself at the time, but really the sort of key protest camps in Sunni majority provinces, those are most of the key issues are in sort of enduring for complaints that concern the sidelining of Sunnis in Iraq. So the use of the security apparatus, especially counterterrorism and the judiciary to target Sunnis, including even very high-ranking political leaders like the Vice President Hashemi and the former Finance Minister Rafiq Ansari, politicized targeted use of de-Ba'athification procedures to marginalize Sunnis both politically and in terms of state institutions, and similarly, concern with what they call ethno-sectarian balance and discrimination against Sunni Arabs in the army and the police, which are massive sources of employment, obviously, in an economy that is struggling to attract the kind of foreign enterprise that actually provides employment to Iraqis. So those sort of basic demands, they concern those kind of enduring points. But the problem really has been in some of the less defensible positions that have come around from sort of underneath or around these claims. So the claim that you often see made that Sunni Arabs actually constitute the majority of the Iraqi population and really Iraq is their country. When you hear Sunni politicians or clerics making that claim, they sound a little bit divorced from reality. Similarly, the use of Ba'ath Party flags, praise for the Ba'ath Party, the claims that all the violence in Iraq is actually perpetrated by Iran, even the stuff that Al-Qaeda claimed, Al-Qaeda is actually working for Iran, Maliki's an Iranian puppet, Baghdad's controlled from Tehran or from Qom, that kind of thing. So those, as those sort of narrative points have come out, it has made softening or easing this crisis much more difficult.
So, I mean, has the Arab Spring sort of affected this narrative, or is sort of the grievances of Sunni Arabs sort of, it's all internal and it's, has very little to do with what's happening outside of Iraq?
I think that there's definitely an interplay between the two. A lot of this is very, sort of goes back to far before the Arab Spring, but in terms of the sort of the timing of how this has happened, it has clearly provided sort of inspiration. So a lot of the anti-government protests you would hear, familiar chants that people want to bring down the regime, that kind of thing. It's provided models for the use of social media to organize protests. So it's provided sort of symbolism and rhetoric, but the model doesn't fit quite the way people might like it. What we're seeing in Iraq is a self-identifying sectarian minority population that is defining itself as such. It's not a popular movement for democracy. So around the time of the Arab Spring, 2011, in 2012, there were protests all over Iraq against the Maliki government, Shia and Sunni, that were focused on the very real failures of the Maliki government. It's an oil-rich state. Where is the employment? Where is the electricity? Where's the clean water, unfair distribution of wealth, these kind of things. This time round, since December when these protests started, virtually no protests in Shia areas. And in fact, early on we saw counter-protests in support of Maliki. So it's more kind of like Syria. I would maybe describe it as a movement or movements that took some inspiration from the Arab Spring, but have very complicated ethno-sectarian dimensions that really raise the stakes. And so, it takes on a different, and those provide, those dimensions provide emotive and political means for mobilization on top of the sort of more democratic side.
So then, what has been the reaction of the government in Baghdad towards this sort of this political situation, this narrative? I mean, has what is the counter narrative that the government in Baghdad is trying to produce or has produced?
Well, the government recognized quite quickly the legitimacy of some of these demands, or at least the efficacy of addressing them. So I think there was maybe a sense when security forces arrested a lot of people close to the former finance minister, Asawi, that maybe this has gone a little bit too far. Regardless of whether any of the things that Asawi or his associates were accused of were actually true, it's a big thing to go after such a well-respected political figure. So I think actually over the first few months, and actually going on from there, the government has made some fairly major concessions to the protesters, pretty serious concessions or offered concessions on de-Ba'athification, which really involved taking some risks vis-a-vis other Shia parties, particularly the Sadrists, who are much more hardline than Maliki is on de-Ba'athification. There have been pretty substantial prisoner transfers, pretty substantial releases of prisoners. They ended the government ended the secret informer law, which was something that was a very key demand of the protesters. So there was definitely a sense that, well, okay, look, this has gone pretty far. This is pretty significant what is happening, and there was an attempt to make some targeted, limited concessions. The problem has been that as the protests first sort of grew and became more inflammatory in rhetoric and demonstrated, there were armed elements among them and that kind of thing, it gifted the government with a very easy way of portraying it as a protest movement that was full of Islamist extremists, that was full of advocates of regionalism, and therefore sort of enemies of a united Iraq, unified Iraq, that it was full of terrorists and Al-Qaeda members, or at least Al-Qaeda supporters, full of Ba'athists. And really, as I say, the political leaders of sort of Sunni Arab Iraq and the protesters themselves not really help themselves. They put forward a list of very maximalist demands that Maliki couldn't possibly agree to without damaging his own political standing among the Shia. Sort of Maliki's rivals among the Sunni Arabs really refused to acknowledge that any of the concessions that he and his government were making were in any way sort of positive. They refused to condemn violence among Sunnis, including Al-Qaeda, refused to even sort of tone down a certain level of reverence for the Ba'ath Party, certainly refused ever to sort of to condemn what happened under Saddam Hussein. And the fact is, there's been plenty of evidence to back up the kind of accusations that that the Maliki government can make about these people. Plenty of jihadist flags, whether Al-Qaeda, Islamic State of Iraq, others that look a lot like them, very evident presence of Ba'athist militants, particularly Jaish Rijal Tariqa Naqshbandiya, the Naqshbandiya organization in Tikrit, in Khawija, in Mosul. Three-star Ba'athist flags and a lot of these protests. And then on top of all of that, there's the conflict in Syria next door. I'm sure you saw Maliki's op-ed, or the op-ed that went out in Maliki's name a month or so ago, where he was able to say very clearly, look, there is a threat of a Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda affiliate ruled entity next door, and this is what I'm trying to prevent happening in Iraq. So he, in many ways, the sort of inability of Sunni protest leaders and even the protesters themselves to dial back on some of the more inflammatory rhetoric gifted the Maliki government with a way of demonizing or at least marginalizing them.
Interesting. So I want to sort of take a look at the larger picture in terms of, you know, violence. I mean, I think on Twitter, people were sort of mentioning that, you know, violence, there has been an uptick in violence in Iraq. And I'm curious, you know, how has the violence sort of affected, you know, the narrative and the politics of Iraq, especially between Sunni and Shia Arabs? I mean, is this, you know, is this violence sort of, is it more terrorism? Is it more insurgent violence? And, you know, where do we place sort of sectarianism in all this?
It's a great question. I mean, sort of in terms of how it affects the politics, in general, you know, violence has always continued in Iraq. You know, violence and politics have sort of have limped along side by side for years and years. But in general, what this kind of uptick in, especially in sectarian violence, does is it makes cross-sectarian or inter-sectarian compromise much, much harder. So politicians who try and reach across the aisle, so to speak, like the Deputy Prime Minister, Saleh al-Mutlaq, even when they try and do that in a way that's fairly obviously self-serving, they get penalized for it. Another good example, early on in the protests, Muqtada al-Sadr voiced admittedly limited support for the protests against the Maliki government. But even so, you know, that was a big deal. But as increased evidence of arms and the Ba'athist flags and the sectarian language came to the fore, it forced the Shia to distance themselves. So that's sort of the general point on how it affects the politics. In terms of characterizing the violence, you know, whether it's terrorist or insurgent, I would say it's a mix of both. On the one hand, you know, massive coordinated waves of car bombs. The vast majority of them can be attributed to Al-Qaeda in Iraq or the Islamic State of Iraq, and that's terrorism. It's politically directed and it's terrorism. They target Shia civilians, they target Shia mosques, they target the government, they target Sunnis who engage in the political process. You know, that's terrorism, plain and simple. On the other hand, what we're seeing in this huge uptick is a large number of engagements with the security forces. So attacks on police checkpoints, attacks on army patrols, whether IEDs or small arms attacks, occasionally mortars. And that's sort of more, that looks more like insurgent attacks. So especially we see a lot of this in senior majority areas and up and around the disputed internal boundaries with the Kurdistan region. Some of it's certainly AQI. They attack security forces. They especially like to attack the Sahwa, the awakening forces, so essentially Sunni Arabs who fight against Al-Qaeda. But it's also JRTM, the Ba'athists. It's also tribal militias. It's also groups like Ansar al-Islam. So that kind of thing looks more like an insurgency against the government itself. That is intent, well, it depends on which group, but is distinct from a sort of blanket Islamist or jihadist terrorism and is more sort of locally or nationally oriented.
Interesting. So, I mean, if you can, I mean, walk us through, I mean, you have this great update on how Sunni Arab organization against the government has gone from a protest movement to armed resistance. I mean, it seems like for a lot of our listeners, I mean, you know, we saw the awakening movement Al-Sahwa in 2006, 2007. So, I mean, how does that, from 2006 to now, how do we go from, a sort of group of armed folks, sort of, fighting on the behalf of the United States and the government of Iraq, implicitly to sort of protest movement and then to what looks like to be a new insurgency or a new sort of violent opposition towards the government in Iraq.
Yeah, it's a very worrying state of affairs. I mean, one thing I would point out sort of up front is there's not really a huge amount of evidence that Sunni Arabs in general, whether they're in Anbar or in Salah ad-Din, are more, are sort of more prone to, or you're more supportive of Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Islamic State of Iraq. I don't. I there was, there were plenty of attempts by AQI to derail the protests. I mean, excuse me, to derail the elections in these areas, and they gave Maliki an opportunity to do so in Inwan Anbar for his own reasons. But in as far as sort of turning away from that in 2000, I guess 2007, 2008. It's not. It's by no means clear that sort of Al-Qaeda in Iraq is picking up momentum in terms of popular support. How to explain that narrative? I mean, really, it's part and parcel of the narrative of Sunni marginalization under the Maliki government. Repeated targeting. From the security forces, repeated marginalization politically, that really picks up with the 2010 elections and the sidelining of Irakia, the sort of secularist but predominantly Sunni supported political coalition. And then sort of their increasing marginalization, their inability to really hold it together, to challenge Maliki. Then the withdrawal of US troops and sort of the gloves coming off. And really, I think it's more the sort of last 6 to 12 months that the inflection has come. And even then, it's been more recent. What we saw at the beginning of the protest movement, starting in late December 2012, was overwhelmingly peaceful. It's hard to look, as as we're seeing today in, well, all of the Arab world and Africa and beyond, it's hard to look at masses of angry people and ascribe peaceful intentions to them. The rhetoric was certainly inflammatory, but there was very little visual evidence of weapons. The rhetoric was not militant for the most part, and the people who emerged as protest spokesmen, whether they were local sort of civil activists or clerics, tended, I mean, the rhetoric they put forward was very, very peaceful, and it was sort of anti-sectarian, but it was, here are our demands, here are our complaints, and this is what we want, but it was not sort of insurgent-oriented. Well, there may have been a sort of dot-dot-dot effect. Well, there was violence through January, beginning of February. It was usually the There was almost always the ISF, Iraqi security forces, who moved first, trying to control or corral or disperse protesters. People got hurt in Mosul in early January. They got hurt in Fallujah later on in January. And in both cases, it was really the ISF that started the confrontation. So generally, political figures, clerical figures were in charge, and they kept the lid on most of the more aggressive tendencies that might have been around the fringe. But as these protests grew in size, and at one point, they really were pretty substantial, and as the people competing to represent them sort of faltered in their interactions with one another and with Maliki, that sectarian rhetoric got heightened. And these camps became places, unfortunately, while Hugh government wasn't being untruthful in calling this, that these camps did become a place where wannabe jihadists or wannabe insurgents or the real deal would be. I mean, that's where they would be. So the flag, the Ba'athist era flags or the ISI flags, the references to Maliki and Iran, Safavid, Najus, that kind of thing became increasingly prevalent as a sort of angry stalemate set in. And really the problem with the maximalist demands that the protest leaders were setting forward was that even substantial concessions like the ones Maliki made in classification were not going to be enough. They really wanted far more than they could ever realistically have hoped to have got. So at that point, around about March, we started to see divisions among the protesters become more apparent, particularly between militant and non-militant groups. So from the largest camp in Ramadi, in Anbar, there was an attempt to push among sort of young, more militant men, there was an attempt to push the protest in a more violent direction, which was overwhelmingly rejected, and so that group went to Fallujah and set up camp there. There was a pretty clear presence of the Free Iraq Uprising and the Free Iraq Intifada, the political wing of the Ba'athists, in Mosul, to a lesser degree in Fallujah, but certainly in Tikrit, in Khawija, their traditional sort of Ba'athist strongholds. And they really were instrumental in bringing around the major inflection, which was the Khawija raid or incident or crisis, however you want to describe it, in which the ISF attacked the Khawija protest site. A large number of people, 50 or more, were killed, some of them very brutally, which shouldn't obscure the fact that it was really the Ba'athist militants who got what they wanted out of that. They goaded the security forces into attacking. Now, that doesn't obviously excuse what happened, but they got what they wanted out of that. So what came out of that was a mobilization across Sunni Arab Iraq of tribal militias and other groups. It was most visible in Anbar, but there were groups in Salah ad-Din, Kip Cook, and for a while there it really looked like it looked like Iraq was on the edge. In fact, I think we published a piece called Iraq on the Edge. At the same time, efforts at negotiation continued. But of course, it's very hard to demobilize large groups of angry armed people. And then from that point, what we have seen is the decline in protests as, quiet protests. Coverage of the protests has diminished in the media. Where we do see it, we see smaller numbers. All the numbers are no longer being reported, which obviously suggests that they're less significant. Far fewer pictures being posted on social media. Social media was really a way that we were tracking what was happening, because there was a huge outpouring of coverage, especially on Facebook, but also Twitter and YouTube. And at one point, there were Facebook pages that were being used clearly both to mobilize and to publicize. So they'd be in both Arabic and English. And they'd be updated multiple times an hour with pages from protests, from heat all the way up to Kirkuk. And videos, photos, slogans showing huge numbers of protesters all over the place, very clearly laying out what they were doing, where they were, where they were meeting, all the rest of it. By the time that we wrote the update that you referred to, which I think was sort of mid June, most of those, if not all of those pages and sites and accounts were barely covering protests at all. Instead, they were covering armed groups, unnamed groups. It's not like Syria where you see, you know, formation videos with the "we are the this brigade" and, you know, "this is where we're being formed." It's much more, it's much less clear than that. But armed tribal militias, or tribal heroes, that kind of thing. And it's just a lot more sort of sloganeering about revolution, about getting rid of the government, occasionally about jihad, but primarily militant in orientation. Now, there's not the same level of clarity that we had on the protest. Here they are, they're happening here, this is why, this is who they are, etc. It's much more fluid, but it's clear that the focus has turned towards insurgent is probably the best word, towards a sort of insurgent direction. Now, obviously, a good deal of this is certainly propaganda or it's bravado, but the fact is we are seeing high levels of attacks on security forces in Sunni Arab areas, and, you know, it's highly likely, I would say, that there is a correlation between these groups and those attacks. So that's sort of broadly the narrative that we've seen, at least, you know, maybe not going back to 2006, but over the last year or so.
Now, I'm curious, I mean, how much does, not just Maliki, but sort of the political stalemate at large in Baghdad play into this? I mean, it seems like Sunnis, they have the representation, but to your point, they're marginalized. So, I mean, within the larger political system, I mean, is sort of this stalemate contributing to marginalization, that services are not going out to particular Sunni Arab areas? Or is this more, when you make the reference to marginalization, this is sort of intentional and sort of with a sort of energy behind it, in the sense that it's not just political stalemate, but, you know, the Maliki government is going out and actively sort of marginalizing Sunni politicians and Sunni areas.
It's a good point. You know, the fact is, the thing about Iraqi politics is they can, you know, parliamentarians can barely get anything done on the best of days. You know, parliament scrapes over quorum if it manages it, which means that stalemate is always a couple of months away. You know, a couple of people get up and walk out of the chamber, and there you go, nothing's happening in parliament that day. So it's sort of a mutually reinforcing phenomenon where I think, yeah, on the one hand, there is a genuine history of marginalization that has been very deliberate and very, very targeted. So you don't go after the vice president of a country by accident. You don't go after the finance minister of a country, and generally thought of to be a very good finance minister, by accident. You know, you don't essentially push the winning coalition in a national election into a minority position by accident. But that's a good example of the other side of the coin, which is that Sunni Iraqi politicians have not been very effective in countering this. And, you know, the fact is they are a minority, right? So they are not in a strong position. And generally, in a three-sided equation, they are not in a strong position because generally relations with the Kurds are not good, especially for those that, you know, the Najafis, for instance, and people who come from who draw strong political support from the disputed areas with the Kurds. That's a difficult equation to deal with. So, you know, it's there's a chicken and an egg quality to it. the fact is that where I see it sort of playing in, especially to the protests, is a sense that, well, okay, well, we have representation, but it never gets us anywhere, you know. And so actually what we saw was those clerics especially and protest leaders who were trying to sort of represent themselves as, and in many ways very effectively, as representatives of the protest, as spokesmen, generally wanted as little to do with politicians as they could get away with, because that's an entire group of people who are tainted by years of failure to stand up the monarchy, to put together, you know, they essentially snatched defeat from the jaws of victory in 2010, and have hardly covered themselves in glory since. And I suspect that, you know, some of the results of the provincial elections have sort of endorsed that view. So there's a sense in which, well, okay, we have some representation, but the odds are stacked against them, and anyway, they're kind of useless, I think, is probably the layman's way of putting it.
So let me finish our interview off with Syria. We touched on this earlier in the conversation, but how has Syria affected the politics and sort of violence in Iraq? Because I think, you know, you made mention that sort of, I think Maliki was sort of demonizing, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of pointing out that sort of these Sunni radicals are, you know, they're trying to bring down the regime or something like that. You know, how has Syria affected this sort of dynamic that you've described?
Well, in all sorts of ways, but in that particular case, it really provides Maliki with something he can point to and say, is this what you want? Is this, do you want, you know, countless numbers of opposition groups of various shapes and sizes and orientations fighting amongst themselves and with a generally much stronger government that, by the way, is also going to get a significant amount of support from Iran? Obviously, that's not, he doesn't have to say that. So really, from his point of view, I think he laid it out, that op-ed or whoever wrote it for him laid it out very well, that really Syria is the threat, is what loomed on the horizon if Iraq begins to break up along sectarian lines, or if really people push the attempt to oust him too far. And you know, it feeds in many ways, as I said before, it provides inspiration to would-be jihadists or would-be rebels. And I'm sure that the interplay, I mean, we've seen in the last few weeks the interplay between the Islamic State of Iraq and Jabhat al-Nusra. Those two groups clearly not getting along, at least at the leadership level, but those links are there. The border between Iraq and Syria is extremely porous. And I think there's a fairly sensible fear that at a certain point the Iraqis who are fighting in Syria, and not just Iraqis, will come back over those borders, and they'll be fighting in Baghdad instead of Damascus. That's a real fear for Maliki. And it's not an inaccurate one for him to have. It's not, you know, not a silly fear. And really, he can use that to mobilize. He is, I think, using that to mobilize Iraqi Shia fighting in Damascus. He can use it to justify some of his more repressive tactics, or even just the stall reform, which is, you know, the sort of reforms that were being put forward in terms of the Ba'athification haven't really gone anywhere since. So, you know, they're separate countries, but they affect each other very strongly. Syria is affecting, you know, the entire region at the moment. And in many ways, it might be too soon to say that we understand the implications of the Iraq War. It might also be too soon to say that we understand the implications of what's been going on in Syria, but it's very hard to divorce one from the other.
So, I mean, before we sort of end the conversation, you know, I always like to have my guests give us a last comment or a last sort of, you know, summary. You know, did we miss anything? Did, you know, anything you want to hit on?
I mean, I guess what I would say, as someone who for a while at least was fairly optimistic about Iraq's direction. I'm sorry to say, but I think the last few months has made me feel as though I was extremely naive in that regard. And I think even looking beyond the headlines, even what you see, if you pick up the New York Times, you see car bombs in Baghdad, and that's likely to be the only other time that you see Iraq in the headlines, unless you particularly follow the intricacies of the energy sector. But unfortunately, when you scratch the surface, there's a whole rotten edifice under there as well. The direction it's going to go in is extremely worrying. Iraq is not back in civil war, but there are very few good ways out of the impasse that it's in. And I think with Syria next door, the intentions of regional actors to help it out, to help it sort of out of quagmire and into something more progressive, are relatively few. So I think all I would say is Iraq is central to the region. It's an incredibly important state in the Middle East and in the Arab world, and by ignoring it, we sort of really fail to understand regional dynamics more broadly. So I would urge everyone to keep an eye on Iraq and keep an eye on its interplay with Syria.
Good. Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.